This is Audible.
Please see the PDF that accompanies this program for additional materials. This publication contains the opinions and ideas of its author. It is sold with the understanding that the author and publisher are not engaged in rendering health services in the book. The reader should consult his or her own medical and health providers as appropriate before adopting any of the suggestions in this book or drawing inferences from it. The author and publisher specifically disclaim all responsibility for any liability, loss, or risk, personal or otherwise, which is incurred as a consequence, directly or indirectly, of the use and application of any of the contents of this book. Simon & Schuster Audio presents Lifespan, Why We Age and Why We Don't Have To, written and read by David A. Sinclair, with Matthew D. LaPlante.
To my grandmother Vera, who taught me to see the world the way it could be. To my mother, Diana, who cared more about her children than herself. To my wife, Sandra, my bedrock. And to my great-great-grandchildren, I am looking forward to meeting you. Introduction. A Grandmother's Prayer. I grew up on the edge of the bush. In figurative terms, my backyard was a 100-acre wood. In literal terms, it was much bigger than that. It went on as far as my young eyes could see, and I never grew tired of exploring it. I would hike and hike, stopping to study the birds, the insects, the reptiles. I pulled things apart. I rubbed the dirt between my fingers. I listened to the sounds of the wild and tried to connect them to their sources. And I played. I made swords from sticks and forts from rocks. I climbed trees and swung on branches and dangled my legs over steep precipices and jumped off things that I probably shouldn't have jumped off. I imagined myself as an astronaut on a distant planet. I pretended to be a hunter on safari. I lifted my voice for the animals as though they were an audience at the opera house. "Coo-wee," I would holler, which means come here in the language of the Garigal people, the original inhabitants. I wasn't unique in any of this, of course. There were lots of kids in the northern suburbs of Sydney who shared my love of adventure and exploration and imagination. We expect this of children. We want them to play this way. Until, of course, they're too old for that sort of thing. Then we want them to go to school. Then we want them to go to work, to find a partner, to save up, to buy a house. Because, you know, the clock is ticking. My grandmother was the first person to tell me that it didn't have to be that way. Or, I guess, she didn't tell me so much as show me. She had grown up in Hungary, where she spent bohemian summers swimming in the cool waters of Lake Balaton and hiking in the mountains of its northern shore at a holiday resort that catered to actors, painters, and poets. In the winter months, she helped run a hotel in the Buddha Hills before the Nazis took it over and converted it to the central command of the Schutzstaffel, or SS. A decade after the war, in the early days of the Soviet occupation, the communists began to shut down the borders. When her mother tried to cross illegally into Austria, she was caught, arrested, and sentenced to 2 years in jail, and died shortly after. During the Hungarian uprising in 1956, my grandmother wrote and distributed anti-communist newsletters in the streets of Budapest. After the revolution was crushed, the Soviets began arresting tens of thousands of dissidents, and she fled to Australia with her son, my father, reasoning that it was the furthest they could get from Europe. She never set foot in Europe again, but she brought every bit of Bohemia with her. She was, I've been told, one of the first women to sport a bikini in Australia and got chased off Bondi Beach because of it. She spent years living in New Guinea, which even today is one of the most intensely rugged places on our planet, all by herself. Though her bloodline was Ashkenazi Jew and she had been raised a Lutheran, My grandmother was a very secular person. Our equivalent of the Lord's Prayer was the English author Alan Alexander Milne's poem, Now We Are Six, which ends, "But now I am six, I am as clever as clever, so I think I'll be six now, forever and ever." She read that poem to my brother and me again and again. Six, she told us, was the very best age, and she did her damnedest to live life with the spirit and awe of a child that age. Even when we were very young, my grandmother didn't want us to call her grandmother, nor did she like the Hungarian term Nagy Mama, or any of the other warm terms of endearment such as Bubby, Grandma, and Nana. To us boys and everyone else, she was simply Vera. Vera taught me to drive, swerving and swaying across all of the lanes, dancing to whatever music was on the car's radio. She told me to enjoy my youth, to savor the feeling of being young. Adults, she said, always ruin things. Don't grow up, she said. Never grow up. Well into her 60s and 70s, she was still what we call young at heart, drinking wine with friends and family, eating good food, telling great stories, helping the poor, the sick, and less fortunate, pretending to conduct symphonies, laughing late into the night. By just about anyone's standard, that's the mark of a life well lived. But yes, the clock was ticking. By her mid-80s, Vera was a shell of her former self, and the final decade of her life was hard to watch. She was frail and sick. She still had enough wisdom left to insist that I marry my fiancée Sandra, but by then music gave her no joy, and she hardly got out of her chair. The vibrancy that had defined her was gone. Toward the end, she gave up hope. "This is just the way it goes," she told me. She died at the age of 92, and in the way we've been taught to think about these things, she'd had a good, long life. But the more I have thought about it, the more I have come to believe that the person she truly was had been dead for many years at that point. Growing old may seem a distant event, but every one of us will experience the end of life. After we draw our last breath, our cells will scream for oxygen, toxins will accumulate, chemical energy will be exhausted, and cellular structures will disintegrate. A few minutes later, all of the education, wisdom, and memories that we cherished, and all of our future potential, will be irreversibly erased. I learned this firsthand when my mother, Diana, passed away. My father, my brother, and I were there. It was a quick death, thankfully, caused by a buildup of liquid in her remaining lung. We had just been laughing together about the eulogy I'd written on the trip from the United States to Australia, and then suddenly she was writhing on the bed, sucking for air that couldn't satisfy her body's demand for oxygen, staring at us with desperation in her eyes. I leaned in and whispered into her ear that she was the best mum I could have wished for. Within a few minutes, her neurons were dying, erasing not just the memory of my final words to her, but all of her memories. I know some people die peacefully, but that's not what happened to my mother. In those moments, she was transformed from the person who had raised me into a twitching, choking mass of cells, all fighting over the last residues of energy being created at the atomic level of her being. All I could think was, no one tells you what it's like to die. Why doesn't anyone tell you? There are few people who have studied death as intimately as the Holocaust documentary filmmaker Claude Lanzmann. And his assessment, indeed his warning, is chilling. "Every death is violent," he said in 2010. "There is no natural death, unlike the picture we like to paint of the father who dies quietly in his sleep, surrounded by his loved ones. I don't believe in that." Even if they don't recognize its violence, children come to understand the tragedy of death surprisingly early in their lives. By the age of 4 or 5, they know that death occurs and is irreversible. It is a shocking thought for them, a nightmare that is real. At first, because it's calming, most children prefer to think that there are certain groups of people who are protected from death: parents, teachers, and themselves. Between 5 and 7, however, all children come to understand the universality of death. Every family member will die, every pet, every plant, everything they love, themselves too. I can remember first learning this. I can also very well remember our oldest child, Alex, learning it. Dad, won't you always be around? Sadly, no, I said. Alex cried on and off for a few days, then stopped, and never asked me about it again. And I've never again mentioned it either. It doesn't take long for the tragic thought to be buried deep in the recesses of our subconscious. When asked if they worry about death, children tend to say that they don't think about it. If asked what they do think about it, they say it's not a concern because it will occur only in the remote future when they get old. That's a view most of us maintain well into our 50s. Death is simply too sad and paralyzing to dwell on each day. Often we realize it too late. When it comes knocking and we are not prepared, it can be devastating. For Robin Moranz Hennig, a columnist at the New York Times, the bitter truth about mortality came late in life, after she became a grandparent. Beneath all the wonderful moments you may be lucky enough to share in and enjoy, she wrote, your grandchild's life will be a long string of birthdays you will not live to see. It takes courage to consciously think about your loved one's mortality before it actually happens. It takes even more courage to deeply ponder your own. It was the comedian and actor Robin Williams who first demanded this courage from me through his portrayal of John Keating, the teacher and hero in the film Dead Poets Society, who challenges his teenage students to stare into the faces of the long dead boys in a fading photo. They are not that different from you, are they? Keating says. Invincible, just like you feel. Their eyes are full of hope. But you see, gentlemen, these boys are now fertilizing daffodils. Keating encourages the boys to lean in closer, to listen for a message from the grave. Standing behind them in a quiet, ghostly voice, he whispers, carpe, carpe diem. Seize the day, boys. Make your lives extraordinary. That scene had an enormous impact on me. It is likely that I would not have had the motivation to become a Harvard professor if it hadn't been for that movie. At the age of 20, I had finally heard someone else say what my grandmother had taught me at an early age. Do your part to make humanity the best it can be. Don't waste a moment. Embrace your youth. Hold on to it for as long as you can. Fight for it. Fight for it. Never stop fighting for it. But instead of fighting for youth, we fight for life. Or, more specifically, we fight against death. As a species, we are living much longer than ever. But not much better. Not at all. Over the past century, we have gained additional years, but not additional life. Not life worth living, anyway. And so most of us, when we think about living to 100, still think, God forbid, because we've seen what those final decades look like, and for most people, most of the time, they don't look appealing at all. Ventilators and drug cocktails, broken hips and diapers, chemotherapy and radiation, surgery after surgery after surgery, and hospital bills. My God, the hospital bills. We're dying slowly and painfully. People in rich countries often spend a decade or more suffering through illness after illness at the ends of their lives. We think this is normal. As lifespans continue to increase in poorer nations, this will become the fate of billions of additional people. Our successes in extending life, the surgeon and Dr. Atul Gawande has noted, have had the effect of making mortality a medical experience. But what if it didn't have to be that way? What if we could be younger, longer? Not years longer, but decades longer. What if those final years didn't look so terribly different from the years that came before them? And what if, by saving ourselves, we could also save the world? Maybe we can never be six again, but how about 26 or 36? What if we could play as children do, deeper into our lives, without worrying about moving on to the things that adults have to do so soon? What if all the things that we need to compress into our teenage years didn't have to be so compressed after all? What if we weren't so stressed in our 20s? What if we weren't feeling middle-aged in our 30s and 40s? What if, in our 50s, we wanted to reinvent ourselves and couldn't think of a single reason why we shouldn't? What if, in our 60s, we weren't fretting about leaving a legacy, but beginning one? What if we didn't have to worry that the clock was ticking? And what if I told you that soon, very soon, in fact, We won't. Well, that's what I'm telling you. I'm fortunate that after 30 years of searching for truths about human biology, I find myself in a unique position. If you were to visit me in Boston, you'd most likely find me hanging out in my lab at Harvard Medical School, where I'm a professor in the Department of Genetics and co-director of the Paul F. Glenn Center for the Biological Mechanisms of Aging. I also run a sister lab at my alma mater, the University of New South Wales in Sydney. In my labs, teams of brilliant students and PhDs have both accelerated and reversed aging in model organisms and have been responsible for some of the most cited research in the field, published in some of the world's top scientific journals. I'm also a co-founder of a journal, Aging, that provides space to other scientists to publish their research on one of the most challenging and exciting questions of our time, and co-founder of the Academy for Health and Lifespan Research, a group of the top 20 researchers in aging worldwide. In trying to make practical use of my discoveries, I've helped start a number of biotechnology companies and sit as a chair of the scientific boards of advisors of several others. These companies work with hundreds of leading academics in scientific areas ranging from the origin of life to genomics to pharmaceuticals. I am, of course, aware of my own lab's discoveries years before they are made public, but through these associations, I'm also aware of many other transformational discoveries ahead of time, sometimes a decade ahead. The coming chapters will serve as your backstage pass and your front row seat. Having received the equivalent of a knighthood in Australia and taken on the role of an ambassador, I've been spending quite a bit of my time briefing political and business leaders around the world about the ways our understanding of aging is changing and what that means for humanity going forward. I've applied many of my scientific findings to my own life, as have many of my family members, friends, and colleagues. The results, which, it should be noted, are completely anecdotal, are encouraging. I'm 50, and I feel like a kid. My wife and kids will tell you I act like one too. That includes being a sticky beak, the Australian term for someone who is overly inquisitive, perhaps derived from the Currawong crows that used to punch through the foil lids of milk bottles delivered to our homes and drink milk out of them. My old high school friends still like to tease me about how whenever they came over to my parents' house, they would find me pulling something apart, a pet moth's cocoon, a spider's curled up leaf shelter, an old computer, my father's tools, a car. I became quite good at it. I just wasn't very good at putting these things back together. I couldn't bear not knowing how something worked or where it came from. I still can't, but at least now I get paid for it. My childhood home is perched on a rocky mountainside. Below is a river that runs into Sydney Harbour. Arthur Phillip, the first governor of New South Wales, explored these valleys in April 1788, only a few months after he and his first fleet of Marines, prisoners and their families established a colony on the shores of what he called the finest and most extensive harbour in the universe. The person most responsible for him being there was the botanist Sir Joseph Banks, who 18 years earlier had sailed up the Australian coastline with Captain James Cook on his voyage round the world. After returning to London with hundreds of plant specimens to impress his colleagues, Banks lobbied King George III to start a British penal colony on the continent, the best site for which, he argued, not coincidentally, would be a bay called Botany on Cape Banks. The first fleet settlers soon discovered that Botany Bay, despite its most excellent name, had no source of water. So they sailed up to Sydney Harbour and found one of the world's largest rias, a highly branched deep waterway that formed when the Hawkesbury River system had been flooded by rising sea levels after the last ice age. At the age of 10, I had already discovered through exploration that the river in my backyard flowed down into Middle Harbour, a branch of Sydney Harbour. But I could no longer stand not knowing where the river originated. I needed to know what the beginning of a river looked like. I followed it upstream, left the first time it forked and right the time after that, wending into and out of several suburbs. By nightfall, I was miles from home, beyond the last mountain on the horizon. I had to ask a stranger to let me call my mother to beg her to come pick me up. A few times after that, I tried searching upstream, but I never did get anywhere close to the fount. Like Juan Ponce de Leon, the Spanish explorer of Florida known for his apocryphal quest to find the Fountain of Youth, I failed. Ever since I can remember, I have wanted to understand why we grow old. But finding the source of a complex biological process is like searching for the spring at the source of a river. It's not easy. On my quest, I've wound my way left and right and had days when I wanted to give up. But I've persevered. Along the way, I've seen a lot of tributaries, but I've also found what may be the spring. In the coming chapters, I will present a new idea about why aging evolved and how it fits into what I call the information theory of aging. I will also tell you why I have come to see aging as a disease, the most common disease, one that not only can, but should be aggressively treated. That's part one. In part two, I will introduce you to the steps that can be taken right now and new therapies in development that may slow, stop, or reverse aging, bringing an end to aging as we know it. And yes, I fully recognize the implication of the words bringing an end to aging as we know it. So, in part three, I will acknowledge the many possible futures these actions could create and propose a path to a future that we can look forward to, a world in which the way we can get to an increased lifespan is through an ever-rising health span, the portion of our lives spent without disease or disability. There are plenty of people who will tell you that's a fairy tale, closer to the works of H.G. Wells than those of C.R. Darwin. Some of them are very smart. A few are even people who understand human biology quite well and whom I respect. Those people will tell you that our modern lifestyles have cursed us with shortening lifespans. They'll say that you're unlikely to see 100 years of age and that your children aren't likely to get to the century mark either. They'll say they've looked at the science of it all and done the projections, and it sure doesn't seem likely that your grandchildren will get to their 100th birthdays either. And they'll say that if you do get to 100, you probably won't get there healthy, and you definitely won't be there for long. And if they grant you that people will live longer, they'll tell you that it's the worst thing for this planet. Humans are the enemy. They've got good evidence for all of this. The entire history of humanity, in fact. Sure. Little by little, millennia by millennia, we've been adding years to the average human life, they will say. Most of us didn't get to 40, and then we did. Most of us didn't get to 50, and then we did. Most of us didn't get to 60, and then we did. By and large, these increases in life expectancy came as more of us gained access to stable food sources and clean water. And largely the average was pushed upward from the bottom. Deaths during infancy and childhood fell, and life expectancy rose. This is the simple math of human mortality. But although the average kept moving up, the limit did not. As long as we've been recording history, we have known of people who have reached their 100th year and who might have lived a few years beyond that mark. But very few reach 110. Almost no one reaches 115. Our planet has been home to more than 100 billion humans so far. We know of just one, Jean Calment of France, who ostensibly lived past the age of 120. Most scientists believe she died in 1997 at the age of 122, although it's possible that her daughter replaced her to avoid paying taxes. Whether or not she actually made it to that age really doesn't matter. Others have come within a few years of that age, but most of us, 95% to be precise, are dead before 100. So it certainly makes sense when people say that we might continue to chip away at the average, but we're not likely to move the limit. They say it's easy to extend the maximum lifespan of mice or of dogs, but we humans are different. We simply live too long already. They are wrong. There's also a difference between extending life and prolonging vitality. We are capable of both, but simply keeping people alive decades after their lives have become defined by pain, disease, frailty, and immobility is no virtue. Prolonged vitality, meaning not just more years of life, but more active, healthy, and happy ones, is coming. It is coming sooner than most people expect. By the time the children who are born today have reached middle age, Jean Calment may not even be on the list of the top 100 oldest people of all time. And by the turn of the next century, a person who is 122 on the day of his or her death may be said to have lived a full, though not particularly long, life. 120 years might not be an outlier, but an expectation. So much so that we won't even call it longevity. We will simply call it life. And we will look back with sadness on the time in our history in which it was not so. What's the upward limit? I don't think there is one. Many of my colleagues agree. There is no biological law that says we must age. Those who say there is don't know what they're talking about. We're probably still a long way off from a world in which death is a rarity, but we're not far from pushing it ever farther into the future. All of this, in fact, is inevitable. Prolonged healthy lifespans are in sight. Yes, the entire history of humanity suggests otherwise. But the science of lifespan extension in this particular century says that the previous dead ends are poor guides. It takes radical thinking to even begin to approach what this will mean for our species. Nothing in our billions of years of evolution has prepared us for this, which is why it's so easy and even alluring to believe that it simply cannot be done. But that's what people thought about human flight too, up until the moment someone did it. Today, the Wright brothers are back in their workshop, having successfully flown their gliders down the sand dunes of Kitty Hawk. The world is about to change. And just as was the case in the days leading up to December 17, 1903, the majority of humanity is oblivious. There was simply no context with which to construct the idea of controlled, powered flight back then. So the idea was fanciful, magical, the stuff of speculative fiction. Then, liftoff, and nothing was ever the same again. We are at another point of historical inflection. What hitherto seemed magical will become real. It is a time in which humanity will redefine what is possible, a time of ending the inevitable. Indeed, it is a time in which we will redefine what it means to be human. For this is not just the start of a revolution, it is the start of an evolution. This is David Sinclair.
And this is Matthew LaPlante.
If you're listening to this, you've just gotten through the introduction of the audio version of Lifespan.
And if you'd like to skip ahead, you totally can. But in between chapters, we wanted to let you in on a little bit of the process of how this book was written and how we worked together to make it come to life.
Because I love to write, but I'm not a writer.
And I love science, but I'm not a scientist. But what we created together was better than what either of us could have created alone.
It sure was. So every few weeks we got together, usually in my office at Harvard Medical School, to talk about the science of aging, to map out the story, and to go over what Matt had written so far.
And in between those visits, we spent a lot of time on the phone.
We sure did. We got to know each other better than our own partners. During those conversations, you pushed me to be the best possible scientist. And together, we even came up with experiments to test these theories that are at the heart of this book.
And David, you pushed me to be a better writer, to go deeper into the facts and the historical events.
And the best part about it is that we have a very similar sense of humor.
Dark and inappropriate?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank goodness for editors. And I should say, thank goodness for illustrators, too. This book includes illustrations by Catherine Delfia. She's a board-certified medical illustrator, and it's really quite beautiful. You can see her drawings in the PDF that accompanies this program.
It's such a unique book. I've heard that by the time the process is done, authors often come to be bored with their book. But I really never grow tired of reading it. It's part science, part history, part philosophy. Somehow, Matthew, you managed to stitch it all together.
Well, that's nice to hear, but really that can only happen because we got to spend so much time together. So what the listeners are going to be hearing between chapters are the sorts of conversations we had during this process.
So we're recording these in the studio for the benefit of sound quality. We're going to try to do each one of these segments in one take so that you can really hear how we interact with one another.
Our telephone chats weren't usually very long. They often lasted just a few minutes. And in that time, I'd ask David about something I'd read or I'd seen or an idea I had while I was writing.
Yeah, often I was driving home or doing something else, and we managed to squeeze it into both of our busy schedules. You're an academic, I'm an academic, we have day jobs. So how about we offer an example?
Okay. So we just heard you reading in the introduction about how some people, even people who are respected colleagues, I think, think your idea that we can all live substantially longer and substantially healthier lives is, well, I think the word you use is a fairy tale. And it occurred to me that I've actually never asked you how it feels to not only have to defend your science like most scientists do with rigor and peer review and replication, but also to have to defend the very validity of the sorts of questions you're asking. That's got to be tough.
My whole life has been devoted to this, so I'm pretty much used to talking about it and hearing the opposition. So that's not what gets me down, actually. And Matt, what I haven't told you is I can understand that the folks who haven't thought about this before, and most people haven't, come up with questions. And that's fine to ask questions. What gets me down are my colleagues, professors who say this is the kind of thing that shouldn't be done, or David, you shouldn't be talking about this to the public, and you know, let's just focus on one disease like we have for the last few hundred years rather than go after aging, which they've come to think isn't real science.
The word shouldn't strikes me as a word that is awkward in science. It seems out of place.
Well, yeah, you know, I thought becoming a scientist meant that you could say whatever you wanted as long as it was legal. You know, we call that academic freedom. It hasn't turned out to be that way. When I talk to colleagues, sometimes when I talk to the media and it gets exaggerated, you know, I get a huge number of emails and I get phone calls. I get called into the office and reprimanded. And that's been the hardest part of my career.
I think a lot of people who are faced with that sort of criticism and skepticism might disengage more from public conversations about science. But you've really made a point of putting yourself out there. Why is that?
I'm doing this for a reason. I'm not doing it just because I find it satisfies my curiosity. That's a lot of what scientists do. I'm doing this because I wanted to change the world from a very young age. And science is just part of that goal. If I'm just a scientist, I'm not going to be able to change the world necessarily as much as if I'm out there trying to educate the world and translating these findings, making medicines as well. Yeah, I'm unusual in that I'm mission-oriented rather than just doing this for my curiosity.
Well, I think it's cool to be able to be a part of your mission, so thanks for bringing me on board.
Well, you're playing a big part in this, and I'm certainly grateful for your friendship. Part 1. What We Know. The Past. 1. Viva Primordium. Imagine a planet about the size of our own, about as far from its star, rotating around its axis a bit faster, such that a day lasts about 20 hours. It is covered with a shallow ocean of salty water and has no continents to speak of, just some sporadic chains of basaltic black islands peeking up above the waterline. Its atmosphere does not have the same mix of gases as ours. It is a humid, toxic blanket of nitrogen, methane, and carbon dioxide. There is no oxygen. There is no life. Because this planet, our planet as it was 4 billion years ago, is a ruthlessly unforgiving place. Hot and volcanic, electric, tumultuous. But that is about to change. Water is pooling next to warm thermal vents that litter one of the larger islands. Organic molecules cover all surfaces, having ridden in on the backs of meteorites and comets. Sitting on dry, volcanic rock, these molecules will remain just molecules. But when dissolved in pools of warm water, through cycles of wetting and drying at the pool's edges, a special chemistry takes place. As the nucleic acids concentrate, they grow into polymers, the way salt crystals form when a seaside puddle evaporates. These are the world's first RNA molecules, the predecessors to DNA. When the pond refills, the primitive genetic material becomes encapsulated by fatty acids to form microscopic soap bubbles, the first cell membranes. It doesn't take long, a week perhaps, before the shallow ponds are covered with a yellow froth of trillions of tiny precursor cells filled with short strands of nucleic acids, which today we call genes. Most of the protocells are recycled, but some survive and begin to evolve primitive metabolic pathways until finally the RNA begins to copy itself. That point, marks the origin of life. Now that life has formed, as fatty acid soap bubbles filled with genetic material, they begin to compete for dominance. There simply aren't enough resources to go around. May the best scum win. Day in and day out, the microscopic, fragile life forms begin to evolve into more advanced forms, spreading into rivers and lakes. Along comes a new threat, a prolonged dry season. The level of the scum-covered lakes has dropped by a few feet during the dry season, but the lakes have always filled up again as the rains returned. But this year, thanks to unusually intense volcanic activity on the other side of the planet, the annual rains don't fall as they usually do, and the clouds pass on by. The lakes dry up completely. What remains is a thick yellow crust covering the lake beds. It is an ecosystem defined not by the annual waxing and waning of the waters, but by a brutal struggle for survival. And more than that, it is a fight for the future. Because the organisms that survive will be the progenitors of every living thing to come. Archaea, bacteria, fungi, plants, and animals. Within this dying mass of cells, each scrapping for and scraping by on the merest minimums of nutrients and moisture, each one doing whatever it can to answer the primal call to reproduce, there is a unique species. Let's call it Magna Superstes. That's Latin for great survivor. It does not look very different from the other organisms of the day, but M. superstes has a distinct advantage. It has evolved a genetic survival mechanism. There will be far more complicated evolutionary steps in the eons to come, changes so extreme that entire branches of life will emerge. These changes, the product of mutations, insertions, gene rearrangements, and the horizontal transfer of genes from one species to another, will create organisms with bilateral symmetry, stereoscopic vision, and even consciousness. By comparison, this early evolutionary step looks, at first, to be rather simple. It is a circuit, a gene circuit. The circuit begins with gene A, a caretaker that stops cells from reproducing when times are tough. This is key, because on early planet Earth, most times are tough. The circuit also has a gene B, which encodes for a silencing protein. This silencing protein shuts gene A off when times are good, so the cell can make copies of itself when, and only when, it and its offspring will likely survive. The genes themselves aren't novel. All life in the lake has these two genes. But what makes M. superstes unique is that the gene B silencer has mutated to give it a second function. It helps repair DNA. When the cell's DNA breaks, the silencing protein encoded by gene B moves from gene A to help with DNA repair, which turns on gene A. This temporarily stops all sex and reproduction until the DNA repair is complete. This makes sense because while DNA is broken, sex and reproduction are the last things an organism should be doing. In future multicellular organisms, for instance, cells that fail to pause while fixing a DNA break will almost certainly lose genetic material. This is because DNA is pulled apart prior to cell division from only one attachment site on the DNA, dragging the rest of the DNA with it. If DNA is broken, part of a chromosome will be lost or duplicated. The cells will likely die or multiply uncontrollably into a tumor. With a new type of gene silencer that repairs DNA too, M. superstes has an edge. It hunkers down when its DNA is damaged, then revives. It is super primed for survival. And that's good, because now comes yet another assault on life. Powerful cosmic rays from a distant solar eruption are bathing the Earth, shredding the DNA of all the microbes in the dying lakes. The vast majority of them carry on dividing as if nothing has happened, unaware that their genomes have been broken and that reproducing will kill them. Unequal amounts of DNA are shared between mother and daughter cells, causing both to malfunction. Ultimately, the endeavor is hopeless. The cells all die, and nothing is left. Nothing, that is, but M. superstes. For as the rays wreak their havoc, M. superstes does something unusual. Thanks to the movement of protein B away from gene A to help repair the DNA breaks, gene A switches on and the cells stop almost everything else they are doing, turning their limited energy toward fixing the DNA that has been broken. By virtue of its defiance of the ancient imperative to reproduce, M. superstes has survived. See page 3 in the PDF that accompanies this program. When the latest dry period ends and the lakes refill, M. superstes wakes up. Now it can reproduce. Again and again it does so, multiplying, moving into new biomes, evolving, creating generations upon generations of new descendants. They are our Adam and Eve. Like Adam and Eve, we don't know if M. superstes ever existed. But my research over the past 25 years suggests that every living thing we see around us today is a product of this great survivor, or at least a primitive organism very much like it. The fossil record in our genes goes a long way to proving that every living thing that shares this planet with us still carries this ancient genetic survival circuit in more or less the same basic form. It's there in every plant. It's there in every fungus. It is there in every animal. It is there in us. I propose the reason this gene circuit is conserved is that it is a rather simple and elegant solution to the challenges of a sometimes brutish and sometimes bounteous world that better ensures the survival of the organisms that carry it. It is, in essence, a primordial survival kit that diverts energy to the areas of greatest need, fixing what exists in times when the stresses of the world are conspiring to wreak havoc on the genome, while permitting reproduction only when more favorable times prevail. And it is so simple and so robust that not only did it ensure life's continued existence on the planet, it ensured that Earth's chemical survival circuit was passed on from parent to offspring, mutating and steadily improving, helping life continue for billions of years, no matter what the cosmos brought, and in many cases allowing individuals' lives to continue for far longer than they actually needed to. The human body, though far from perfect and still evolving, carries an advanced version of the survival circuit that allows it to last for decades past the age of reproduction. While it is interesting to speculate why our long lifespans first evolved, the need for grandparents to educate the tribe is one appealing theory. Given the chaos that exists at the molecular scale, it is a wonder we survive 30 seconds, let alone make it to our reproductive years, let alone reach 80 more often than not. But we do, marvelously we do, miraculously we do, for we are the progeny of a very long lineage of great survivors. Ergo, we are great survivors. But there is a trade-off. For this circuit within us, the descendant of a series of mutations in our most distant ancestors, is also the reason we age. And yes, that definite singular article is correct. It is the reason. To everything, there is a reason. If you are taken aback by the notion that there is a singular cause of aging, you are not alone. If you haven't given any thought at all as to why we age, that's perfectly normal too. A lot of biologists haven't given it much thought either. Even gerontologists, doctors who specialize in aging, often don't ask why we age. They simply seek to treat the consequences. This isn't a myopia specific to aging. As recently as the late 1960s, for example, the fight against cancer was a fight against its symptoms. There was no unified explanation for why cancer happens, so doctors removed tumors as best they could and spent a lot of time telling patients to get their affairs in order. Cancer was just the way it goes, because that's what we say when we can't explain something. Then, in the 1970s, genes that cause cancer when mutated were discovered by the molecular biologists Peter Vogt and Peter Duisberg. These so-called oncogenes shifted the entire paradigm of cancer research. Pharmaceutical developers now had targets to go after: the tumor-inducing proteins encoded by genes such as BRAF, HER2, and BCR-ABL. By inventing chemicals that specifically block the tumor-promoting proteins, we could finally begin to move away from using radiation and toxic chemotherapeutic agents to attack cancers at their genetic source, while leaving normal cells untouched. We certainly haven't cured all types of cancer in the decades since then, but we no longer believe it's impossible to do so. Indeed, among an increasing number of cancer researchers, optimism abounds. And that hopefulness was at the heart of what was arguably the most memorable part of President Barack Obama's final State of the Union address in 2016. For the loved ones we've all lost, for the family we can still save, let's make America the country that cures cancer once and for all, Obama said as he stood in the House of Representatives chamber and called for a cancer moonshot. When he placed then-Vice President Joe Biden, whose son Beau had died of brain cancer a year earlier, in charge of the effort, even some of the Democrats' staunch political enemies had trouble holding back the tears. In the days and weeks that followed, many cancer experts noted that it would take far more than the year remaining to the Obama-Biden administration to end cancer. Very few of those experts, however, said it absolutely couldn't be done. And that's because, in the span of just a few decades, we had completely changed the way we think about cancer. We no longer submit ourselves to its inevitability as part of the human condition. One of the most promising breakthroughs in the past decade has been immune checkpoint therapy, or simply immunotherapy. Immune T cells continually patrol our body, looking for rogue cells to identify and kill before they can multiply into a tumor. If it weren't for T cells, we'd all develop cancer in our 20s. But rogue cancer cells evolve ways to fool cancer-detecting T cells so they can go on happily multiplying. The latest and most effective immunotherapies bind to proteins on the cancer cell's surface. It is the equivalent of taking the invisible cloak off cancer cells so T cells can recognize and kill them. Although fewer than 10% of all cancer patients currently benefit from immunotherapy, that number should increase thanks to the hundreds of trials currently in progress. We continue to rail against a disease we once accepted as fate, pouring billions of dollars into research each year, and the effort is paying off. Survival rates for once lethal cancers are increasing dramatically. Thanks to a combination of a BRAF inhibitor and immunotherapy, survival of melanoma brain metastases, one of the deadliest types of cancer, has increased 91% since 2011. Between 1991 and 2016, overall deaths from cancer in the United States declined by 27%. And continue to fall. That's a victory measured in millions of lives. Aging research today is at a similar stage as cancer research was in the 1960s. We have a robust understanding of what aging looks like and what it does to us, and an emerging agreement about what causes it and what keeps it at bay. From the looks of it, aging is not going to be that hard to treat, far easier than curing cancer. Up until the second half of the 20th century, it was generally accepted that organisms grow old and die for the good of the species, an idea that dates back to Aristotle, if not further. This idea feels quite intuitive. It is the explanation proffered by most people at parties, but it is dead wrong. We do not die to make way for the next generation. In the 1950s, the concept of group selection in evolution was going out of style, prompting three evolutionary biologists, J.B.S. Haldane, Peter B. Medawar, and George C. Williams, to propose some important ideas about why we age. When it comes to longevity, they agreed, individuals look out for themselves. Driven by their selfish genes, they press on and try to breed for as long and as fast as they can, so long as it doesn't kill them. In some cases, however, they press on too much, as my great-grandfather, Miklos Vitez, a Hungarian screenwriter, proved to his bride 45 years his junior on their wedding night. If our genes don't ever want to die, why don't we live forever? The trio of biologists argued that we experience aging because the forces of natural selection required to build a robust body may be strong when we're 18, but decline rapidly once we hit 40. Because by then we've likely replicated our selfish genes in sufficient measure to ensure their survival. Eventually, the forces of natural selection hit zero. The genes get to move on. We don't. Medawar, who had a penchant for verbiage, expounded on a nuanced theory called antagonistic pleiotropy. Put simply, it says genes that help us reproduce when we are young don't just become less helpful as we age, they can actually come back to bite us when we are old. 20 years later, Thomas Kirkwood at Newcastle University, framed the question of why we age in terms of an organism's available resources. Known as the disposable soma hypothesis, it is based on the fact that there are always limited resources available to species: energy, nutrients, water. They therefore evolve to a point that lies somewhere between two very different lifestyles: breed fast and die young, or breed slowly and maintain your soma or body. Kirkwood reasoned that organisms can't breed fast and maintain a robust, healthy body. There simply isn't enough energy to do both. Stated another way, in the history of life, any line of creature with a mutation that caused it to live fast and attempt to die old soon ran out of resources and was thus deleted from the gene pool. Kirkwood's theory is best illustrated by fictitious but potentially real-life examples. Imagine you are a small rodent that is likely to be picked off by a bird of prey. Because of this, you'll need to pass down your genetic material quickly, as did your parents and their parents before them. Gene combinations that would have provided a longer-lasting body were not enriched in your species because your ancestors likely didn't escape predation for long, and you won't either. Now consider instead that you are a bird of prey at the top of the food chain. Because of this, your genes, well, actually your ancestors' genes, benefited from building a robust, longer-lasting body that could breed for decades. But in return, they could afford to raise only a couple of fledglings a year. Kirkwood's hypothesis explains why a mouse lives 3 years, while some birds can live to 100. It also quite elegantly explains why the American chameleon lizard, Anolis carolinensis, is evolving a longer lifespan as we speak, having found itself a few decades ago on remote Japanese islands without predators. These theories fit with observations and are generally accepted. Individuals don't live forever, because natural selection doesn't select for immortality in a world where an existing body plan works perfectly well to pass along a body's selfish genes. And because all species are resource limited, they have evolved to allocate the available energy either to reproduction or to longevity, but not to both. And that was as true for M. superstes as it was, and still is, for all species that have ever lived on this planet. All that is, except one: Homo sapiens. Having capitalized on its relatively large brain and a thriving civilization to overcome the unfortunate hand that evolution dealt it, weak limbs, sensitivity to cold, poor sense of smell, and eyes that see well only in daylight and in the visible spectrum, this highly unusual species continues to innovate. It has already provided itself with an abundance of food, nutrients, and water, while reducing deaths from predation, exposure, infectious diseases, and warfare. These were all once limits to its evolving a longer lifespan. With them removed, a few million years of evolution might double its lifespan, bringing it closer to the lifespans of some other species at the top of their game. But it won't have to wait that long, nowhere near that, because this species is diligently working to invent medicines and technologies to give it the robustness of a much longer-lived one, literally overcoming what evolution failed to provide. Crisis mode. Wilbur and Orville Wright could never have built a flying machine without a knowledge of airflow and negative pressure and a wind tunnel. Nor could the United States have put men on the moon without an understanding of metallurgy, liquid combustion, computers, and some measure of confidence that the moon is not made of green cheese. In the same way, if we are to make real progress in the effort to alleviate the suffering that comes with aging, what is needed is a unified explanation for why we age, not just at the evolutionary level, but at the fundamental level. But explaining aging at a fundamental level is no easy task. It will have to satisfy all known laws of physics and all rules of chemistry and be consistent with centuries of biological observations. It will need to span the least understood world between the size of a molecule and the size of a grain of sand, and it should explain simultaneously the simplest and the most complex living machines that have ever existed. It should, therefore, come as no surprise that there has never been a unified theory of aging, at least not one that has held up, though not for lack of trying. One hypothesis, proposed independently by Peter Medawar and Leo Szilard, was that aging is caused by DNA damage and a resulting loss of genetic information. Unlike Medawar, who was always a biologist, who built a Nobel Prize-winning career in immunology, Szilard had come to study biology in a roundabout way. The Budapest-born polymath and inventor lived a nomadic life with no permanent job or address, preferring to spend his time staying with colleagues who satisfied his mental curiosities about the big questions facing humanity. Early in his career, he was a pioneering nuclear physicist and a founding collaborator on the Manhattan Project, which ushered in the age of atomic warfare. Horrified by the countless lives his work had helped end, he turned his tormented mind toward making life maximally long. The idea that mutation accumulation causes aging was embraced by scientists and the public alike in the 1950s and 60s, at a time when the effects of radiation on human DNA were on a lot of people's minds. But although we know with great certainty that radiation can cause all sorts of problems in our cells, it causes only a subset of the signs and symptoms we observe during aging, so it cannot serve as a universal theory. In 1963, the British biologist Leslie Orgel threw his hat into the ring with his error catastrophe hypothesis, which postulated that mistakes made during the DNA copying process lead to mutations in genes, including those needed to make the protein machinery that copies DNA. The process increasingly disrupts those same processes, multiplying upon themselves until a person's genome has been incorrectly copied into oblivion. Around the same time that Szilard was focusing on radiation, Denham Harmon, a chemist at Shell Oil, was also thinking atomically, albeit in a different way. After taking time off to finish medical school at Stanford University, he came up with the free radical theory of aging, which blames aging on unpaired electrons that whiz around within cells, damaging DNA through oxidation, especially in mitochondria, because that's where most free radicals are generated. Harmon spent the better part of his life testing the theory. I had the pleasure of meeting the Harmon family in 2013. His wife told me that Professor Harmon had been taking high doses of alpha-lipoic acid for most of his life to quench free radicals. Considering that he worked tirelessly on his research well into his 90s, I suppose, at the very least, it didn't hurt. Through the 1970s and 80s, Harmon and hundreds of other researchers tested whether antioxidants would extend the lifespan of animals. The results overall were disappointing. Although Harmon had some success increasing the average lifespan of rodents, such as with the food additive butylated hydroxytoluene, none showed an increase in maximum lifespan. In other words, a cohort of study animals might live a few weeks longer on average, but none of the animals was setting records for individual longevity. Science has since demonstrated that the positive health effects attainable from an antioxidant-rich diet are more likely caused by stimulating the body's natural defenses against aging, including boosting the production of the body's enzymes that eliminate free radicals, not as a result of the antioxidant activity itself. If old habits die hard, the free radical idea is heroin. The theory was overturned by scientists within the cloisters of my field more than a decade ago, yet it is still widely perpetuated by purveyors of pills and drinks, who fuel a $3 billion global industry. With all that advertising, it is not surprising that more than 60% of US consumers still look for foods and beverages that are good sources of antioxidants. Free radicals do cause mutations. Of course they do. You can find mutations in abundance, particularly in cells that are exposed to the outside world and in the mitochondrial genomes of old individuals. Mitochondrial decline is certainly a hallmark of aging and can lead to organ dysfunction. But mutations alone, especially mutations in the nuclear genome, conflict with an ever-increasing amount of evidence to the contrary. Arlen Richardson and Holly Van Remen spent about a decade at the University of Texas at San Antonio testing if increasing free radical damage or mutations in mice led to aging. It didn't. In my lab and in others, it has proven surprisingly simple to restore the function of mitochondria in old mice, indicating that a large part of aging is not due to mutations in mitochondrial DNA either, at least not until late in life. Although the discussion about the role of nuclear DNA mutations in aging continues, there is one fact that contradicts all these theories, one that is difficult to refute. Ironically, it was Szilard, in 1960, who initiated the demise of his own theory by figuring out how to clone a human cell. Cloning gives us the answer as to whether or not mutations cause aging. If old cells had indeed lost crucial genetic information, and this was the cause of aging, we shouldn't be able to clone new animals from older individuals. Clones would be born old. It's a misconception that cloned animals age prematurely. It has been widely perpetuated in the media, and even the National Institutes of Health website says so. Yes, it's true that Dolly, the first cloned sheep, created by Keith Campbell and Ian Wilmot at the Roslin Institute at the University of Edinburgh, lived only half a normal lifespan and died of a progressive lung disease. But extensive analysis of her remains showed no sign of premature aging. Meanwhile, the list of animal species that have been cloned and proven to live a normal, healthy lifespan now includes goats, sheep, mice, and cows. Because of the fact that nuclear transfer works in cloning, we can say with a high degree of confidence that aging isn't caused by mutations in nuclear DNA. Sure, it's possible that some cells in the body don't mutate, and those are the ones that end up making successful clones, but that seems highly unlikely. The simplest explanation is that old animals retain all the requisite genetic information to generate an entirely new, healthy animal, and that mutations are not the primary cause of aging. It's certainly no dishonor to those brilliant researchers that their theories haven't withstood the test of time. That's what happens to most science, and perhaps all of it, eventually. In The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, Thomas Kuhn noted that scientific discovery is never complete. It goes through predictable stages of evolution. When a theory succeeds at explaining previously unexplainable observations about the world, it becomes a tool that scientists can use to discover even more. Inevitably, however, new discoveries lead to new questions that are not entirely answerable by the theory, and those questions beget more questions. Soon the model enters crisis mode and begins to drift as scientists seek to adjust it as little as possible to account for that which it cannot explain. Crisis mode is always a fascinating time in science, but one that is not for the faint of heart, as doubts about the views of previous generations continue to grow against the old guard's protestations. But the chaos is ultimately replaced by a paradigm shift, one in which a new consensus model emerges that can explain more than the previous model. That's what happened about a decade ago, as the ideas of leading scientists in the aging field began to coalesce around a new model, one that suggested that the reason so many brilliant people had struggled to identify a single cause of aging was that there wasn't one. In this more nuanced view, aging and the diseases that come with it are the result of multiple hallmarks of aging. Genomic instability caused by DNA damage. Attrition of the protective chromosomal end caps, the telomeres. Alterations to the epigenome that controls which genes are turned on and off. Loss of healthy protein maintenance, known as proteostasis. Deregulated nutrient sensing caused by metabolic changes. Mitochondrial dysfunction. Accumulation of senescent zombie-like cells that inflame healthy cells. Exhaustion of stem cells. Altered intercellular communication and the production of inflammatory molecules. Researchers began to cautiously agree, address these hallmarks and you can slow down aging. Slow down aging and you can forestall disease. Forestall disease and you can push back death. Take stem cells, which have the potential to develop into many other kinds of cells. If we can keep these undifferentiated cells from tiring out, they can continue to generate all the differentiated cells necessary to heal damaged tissues and battle all kinds of diseases. Meanwhile, we're improving the rates of acceptance of bone marrow transplants, which are the most common form of stem cell therapy, and using stem cells for the treatment of arthritic joints, type 1 diabetes, loss of vision, and neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. These stem cell-based interventions are adding years to people's lives. Or take senescent cells, which have reached the end of their ability to divide but refuse to die, continuing to spit out panic signals that inflame surrounding cells. If we can kill off senescent cells or keep them from accumulating in the first place, we can keep our tissues much healthier for longer. The same can be said for combating telomere loss, the decline in proteostasis, and all of the other hallmarks. Each can be addressed one by one, a little at a time, in ways that can help us extend human health spans. Over the past quarter century,